The Morning Show with Declan Meehan on East Coast FM.
We'd like to think that we know what's going on in each other's lives, but we don't, do we? It's okay not to be okay is a phrase that's become increasingly popular over the last number of years, but despite its frequent and widespread use, the prevalence of mental health difficulties continues to have significant impacts on people's lives, and mental health stigma continues to be a barrier to people seeking support.
In 2019, the World Health Organization estimated that 1 in 8 people in the world were living with a mental health disorder. That's roughly 970 million people globally. Since the pandemic, this figure has increased. In just 1 year, people living with anxiety and depressive disorders has risen by 26%. Here in Ireland, a survey by Aware in 2022 revealed worrying levels of anxiety and depression, with 60% of those surveyed experiencing depression, 80% of those living with anxiety.
In 2022 in Ireland, 412 people took their own lives. And while trends over the last 12 years show suicide rates have declined, it's clear there's still so much more to be done to support those experiencing mental health difficulties and to challenge the stigma around it. As a nation, we've become more open to speaking about our mental health, but there's still a long way to go.
Acknowledging and seeking support for mental health difficulties is not a failure. It is a brave and necessary step on the journey to recovery. Anyone can experience mental health difficulties at any time. These supports are available to you. And with this help, recovery is possible.
If you're worried about your mental health or a loved one's mental health, reach out to someone you trust. Talk to your GP or visit the HSE's website for information. It's okay not to be okay.
If you aren't feeling okay, you are not alone. Speak to someone. Speak to anyone. Just speak.
Good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show on Thursday, January 25th. We are live from the Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort in Wicklow for a very special show today that is completely dedicated to mental health. Over the next 2 hours, we look at mental health across all ages, the issues and challenges faced in our community. We'll also discover the range of supports available for people who are struggling with their mental health. And we will be speaking to wellness experts about little things we can do to look after our mental health. We will also speak to mental health volunteers working to provide to those who need it, and we will hear firsthand personal and emotive mental health stories. Now, before we start the show today, we'd like to issue a small trigger warning. Some of the stories we'll hear today talk about suicide and self-harm. And before the end of the show today, we'll also have a very moving performance by Sea of Change Choir. It's a tribute for all those who have died by suicide and for everyone who has been on or is currently going through their own mental health journey. It's a moment to sit and remember and reflect. So that's later. You're very welcome to the programme. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And thank you to our first guest, that is Adam Burke, who's from Jigsaw, the mental health services in Wicklow. You're very welcome, Adam. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Declan, and a thank you to you and the team. I think I'd like to start by saying I think what you're doing today, using your platform, connecting the community with mental health conversations, is hugely commendable. We need more of this, and I think it's actually a huge pleasure and privilege for me to be sat here having these kind of conversations and to listen to the conversations that you're going to share throughout today. So big plaudits to you and the team.
Well, let's start off by asking about Jigsaw Mental Health Services in Wicklow. What is Jigsaw?
Jigsaw is a youth mental health service. So we are the National Centre for Youth Mental Health. We are a charity and we provide supports and resources, if you like, for young people aged 12 to 25 across the country. So we have 14 service hubs. And as you just mentioned there, one of our service hubs is located in Wicklow and serves young people across Wicklow. And I suppose, you know, there's a combination of things that happens. Like, young people can access support directly face to face through our clinical services, which are based in their community. But we also have online online supports as well. And then as a wider organisation, we've got a very strong kind of youth mental health promotion department as well, which promotes mental health in the settings where young people are at.
And how did you come to it?
Well, I'm a youth worker, first and foremost, and I had 14 years experience of working in Bray, in the community, as a youth worker with young people. And I think in all of those years that I was working with young people, it was very evident that the theme of mental health was something that impacted young people consistently. And in fact, from time to time, it could really go through worse patches, if you like. What I knew was Jigsaw provided really, really good support for young people. And I think I would have been part of the voices, certainly, in the community that were championing the idea of a Jigsaw service coming to Wicklow. But when that came to fruition then, the opportunity arose for me to join Jigsaw as an organisation, and I've been working there for the last 3 years.
Yeah, mental health issues can affect people, obviously, of all ages. But why youth? What happens particularly there? I mean, it's a joyous time. Yeah, it can be challenging with school. It can be challenging with maybe relationships, maybe home life or whatever. But tell us about the very specific experiences of young people.
Yeah, I think you've hit a lot of the kind of issues on the head there, like, to be honest with you. But, you know, I think all of us can struggle with change. And I would say that I think those kind of formative years and those teenage years, you know yourself, there's so many changes that you can go through in the period of being like a 12 to 25 year old. If you imagine moving from primary school into secondary school, from junior cycle into senior cycle, you have physical changes that are going on for you. You will go into adulthood as well. Your friendship networks will change over time, and all those things that you mentioned as well. There might be stuff going on at home, there might be stuff going on with your education. There's an awful lot that's going on. But on top of that as well, we know that the teenage brain is developing, young people's brains are developing, so we're figuring out the world for ourselves as well. So like, everything around us is changing. You know, there can be a lot of change, you know, at home, in school, with our social groups, all that kind of stuff. And I think that has an impact on us, and it's how we mind ourselves in that, but also what supports are around us as we go through and navigate that kind of timeline in our life. So that would be some of the key reasons that I've seen in young people as to why they might present with some challenges to their mental health.
And as they're changing from the pre-teens into the teens and then towards the 20s, tell us about, you know, the thoughts and stories that people express to you or share with you. What is happening to them? What is happening to their attitude?
Well, I think young people are very aware of the world around them. I think that's one thing. And I think there's also great expectations. They've expectations that they've placed on themselves for their future, what they'd like to do with their lives, where they'd like to go, who they are as a person. But then other people put expectations on them as well. It might be about passing exams or doing well at a sport or, you know, an activity. They've got a peer group who are nearly like a second family. And friendships are nearly as strong as, you know, sibling relationships or parental relationships. But all those relationships, they come with expectations from their peer group. So I think there's an awful lot, again, that they have to kind of work through and navigate. And that can be difficult. And again, it goes back to, so where are they getting their support from? Who's helping them through this? Do you know what I mean? One thing that I would have seen time and time again, and certainly Jigsaw has done a massive piece of research called the My World Survey, which is available on our website. And that speaks to young people where they're at and what they're experiencing. And the likes of state exams, like they would put pressure on young people. You know, they're all geared towards academic achievement when they're in the school cycle, if you like. So that might put pressure on, where are you going to go to college? How many points do you need in the Leaving Cert to do that? And then there's everything else. You know, a young person's life is not dictated by their academic environment. It's everything else that's going on for them. Where did they get their pocket money? Do they have a part-time job? You know, how did they kind of do their hobbies and interests? There's an awful lot for them to navigate and to think about. And for me, again, it's all about, well, who's supporting them? Who's helping them kind of work through that? And that's where we as adults can have a really vital role, because we've gone through those journeys. We may be able to be a great ally as they navigate those uncertainties.
Do they compare themselves to others?
I think we all do. You know, I'd hate to relegate that to young people. I think we all do. I think we're all guilty of it. And I think when you look at social media is all about comparison. So I think it's natural for us. We all want to do the best for ourselves.
But they're discovering themselves as well, you see. And they're probably saying, well, where do I fit in the world? I don't know. But I'm just trying to think back a long time ago to me. And where do you fit in this? How do you compare to the perception of that person is very successful. I'd never be like them.
Yeah, and do you know, we all want that sense of, like, we're connected with other people. We all want that sense of belonging to a group. And that's why we'll compare ourselves. We're trying to align ourselves with allies. We're trying to find the people that will support us. We're trying to find our network. But of course, as adults, it's easy for me and you to sit here because we've kind of done that over years. We know who our network are. You know, it's a little easier, I would argue, for us because we know who our kind of solid support structure is. But I think in those early formative years, you're only forming that. You're only learning that for yourself. And it comes with errors. It comes with blips. Sometimes you might get it wrong. You realize that a certain support is not for you. And that's okay. But they need to hear that that's okay. They need to hear that they can make mistakes. And they need to hear that they're supported irrespective of any mistakes that they might make.
Are they slow or fast or whatever about coming forward?
That's an interesting one because I would say it's a bit of both. When I think back to my childhood, my teenage years, I would say that young people by comparison today are quicker because it was more stigmatized when I think of my formative years. But that's not to say it's easy. There's still young people that will need that extra support to reach out. And we need to give them as many opportunities, as many kind of signposts, as many signals that actually when you're ready and you need to reach out and talk to somebody, that's okay. And there will be people there to hear you, to listen to you, to respond and support. And I think even what we're doing today is part of that. It only takes one young person to be in the car now on the way to school. They're a little bit late, but on the way to school and to hear on the radio that actually, do you know what? There are communities built around mental health. There are allies who've experienced exactly what you're going through. Your youth worker, your teacher, yes, your local jigsaw service, your parent, your auntie. You know, there's plenty of people within those networks that would be only too happy to support you as best they can if you present with that.
And what services are available? What help is there?
Well, I think, as I say, I do think Jigsaw is a great first port of call.
But what's specific?
Yeah, so I think the website is a great starting point in terms of you can do some self-directed learning, if you like, and explore some of the themes and topics. You know, I heard already today, like, you know, the terms anxiety or depression. You know, we've talked about state exams and the kind of stress that comes with us. We'd have articles and resources and packs on our website to address exactly those. But then if a young person really needs to sit down and talk to somebody and they're living in Wicklow or going to school in Wicklow, they do have Jigsaw Wicklow and they could reach out to that service and see whether, you know, we'd be the right support for them.
Right. And finally, Adam, I mean, looking at people where they're, What would I say? Were there any hopeless cases that you had to work at and you feel fantastic when, you know, I don't mean that you feel, oh, that's great, I've done a good job, but you feel, wow, you know, those people, you know, I knew it was going to be difficult, but we've achieved something here. They're happy and I'm happy for them.
Oh, like, absolutely. Like, so I suppose my role in Jigsaw is not a clinical role. I speak with communities. I promote mental health across communities, but I don't sit in a therapeutic room with young people. But when I think back to my days as a youth worker, there are absolutely lots and lots of examples of young people where I would never say a young person is a lost or hopeless cause, but there'd be plenty of young people that you'd look at and what they present in the first instance looks like it's going to be tricky to navigate together. But actually, once you're on that path together, once you're navigating it, once you're making those kind of positive contributions in the space, there's no end to the surprises from young people in terms of them reaching their and exceeding their potential. So that's actually a large part of what keeps me in this sector of work. Like, young people will always go above and beyond to blow your socks off in terms of what they're capable of achieving.
And the best way to contact Jigsaw is?
I'd say jigsaw.ie in the first instance. I'm from jigsaw.ie because I'm aware there might be people even beyond Wicklow who are listening today. So you can go to jigsaw.ie and you can find your local Jigsaw service. And if you fall outside of a Jigsaw catchment area, there's plenty of resources and supports online. So it's www.jigsaw.ie.
Well done. And thank you for coming in. And I'm sure our conversation this morning was very useful to many people who are maybe thinking about themselves and their place in life and some difficulties they have. So thank you very much indeed, Adam.
A pleasure. Thank you.
That's Adam Burke. We're broadcasting live in the morning show this morning from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort here in Wicklow. And we'll be back having a chat about body dysmorphia in just a second.
Morning show
with Declan Meehan
on East Coast FM.
Now, we're broadcasting live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort. We have a mental health special today, but even calling it that takes away from where we're going to achieve this morning, talking to various people who work in mental health and people who have gone through their own journeys with it. We're going to talk now about body dysmorphia. It's something that's often joked about in our society, the kind of thing you might say lightheartedly when someone puts down their own appearance. It's almost akin to saying, you cannot possibly be seeing what I see when I look at you. But body dysmorphic disorder, BDD, is no laughing matter and was in fact categorised as a diagnosis in 1987. It's linked to anxiety, disordered eating and obsessive compulsive disorder. BDD involves a focus on one or more perceived defects or flaws in physical appearance that appear minimal or non-existent to others. According to BodyWise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland, those affected may engage in repetitive behaviours like mirror checking and skin picking. They may insistently seek reassurance, compare themselves to others to an unhealthy degree, and have a preoccupation on weight, and they're focused particularly on that. Now, Keith Russell is with us. He's been living with BDD for most of his life, and he joins us now at Druids Glen. Good morning to you, Keith. Thanks for coming into us this morning.
Morning, Declan. How are you?
Good morning. That's a sort of a background to body dysmorphia. Tell us about you and what you were experiencing, and then we go on to how you identified it.
I suppose I've been living with body dysmorphia since I was about 13 years of age. And obviously at the time I didn't know what it was, and even up until a few years ago I didn't know what it was. I only heard the term a few years ago. But I suppose when you get a diagnosis and you hear a term, you can kind of start linking everything back to that. So it was kind of a validation for me. But yeah, it started when I was about 13, kind of going to the local swimming pool and just becoming very self-conscious in how you look and just becoming very aware of yourself. And you start comparing yourself to other people. And obviously, as you said in the intro there, it is about perceived flaws. And they are a lot of the time in your own head. And a lot of people will say to you, like, you don't look like you have anything wrong with it. But people can tell you that all day long and you wouldn't believe them. So I just would spend a lot of time nearly looking at yourself in the mirror, which is where I think a lot of confusion comes from it, because people can think that you might be vain or you might be... You know, you can might appear that you have a lot of self-confidence when it's actually the complete opposite. It would control my entire life from the first thing I'd wake up in the morning till the last thing I would think about when I go to bed at night. You'd be constantly thinking about these flaws that you think you have. I stopped going out anywhere. I stopped socialising. I pulled away from a lot of friends. I would cry myself to sleep a lot of the time. I developed this very dark hatred for myself. I just didn't like how I looked. I didn't think I was worthy of happiness, of love, of anything. Food would come in a lot of the time as well. You try and control food. The obsessive compulsive disorder you talk about at the beginning, like I'd get very obsessive about the food, I'd get very obsessive about exercising. I'd get very obsessive about a lot of things. You get obsessed about the flaws that you think you have. And it just goes round and round and round, and you just never seem to get anywhere with it. Mm-hmm. And I think being a man as well, or being a boy, obviously at the time, and then an adolescent, you know, and then a man now, I think it's very hard for men to speak about these things, and it's very hard to open up. And I swept a lot of things under the rug for quite a long time, up until probably the last few years when I started to write about it.
Right, and did you think you were inferior, or were you comparing yourself to others, or was it entirely coming out of yourself when you'd look in the mirror and you had this image of what you were supposed to be?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, I asked a lot of the time, did you ever have, say, posters on your wall, or does everything, did you ever want to look like someone else? And I always say no, I just didn't want to look like me, which is kind of heartbreaking when you think about it, because I didn't even want to be look like someone else. You know, you just didn't want to be yourself. I mean, I got to the point where I just didn't even want, I didn't even like my shadow on the ground. That's how irrational it can be. You look at the ground and you'd see a silhouette of your shadow and you're like, I just don't even like that. You know, it can just be demoralising. It's mentally and physically draining. It's emotionally draining. You know, it's like, and then obviously if you don't open up and talk to anyone, no one really knows what's going on because I hit it so well. I hit everything well, I think, because it was only when I opened up about a couple of years ago, a lot of people would say, okay, Kate, we never knew there was anything wrong with you. You know, and even now, like, people like say, you don't look like you have anything wrong with you. How could you have, you know, but it's not, it's all in your head.
Yeah. And I mean, when people weren't reacting to your perceived flaws, I mean, did that not give you an inkling? You know, there was nothing to be concerned about.
No, because it's all in your own head, and you just get this narrative in your head that, you know, you think you have these flaws, and no matter what anyone would say or not say to you, it doesn't really make a difference to you, because if you don't believe it yourself, you're not going to believe what anyone else says. Do you know what I mean? And like now I've got so much self-acceptance now, I've got so much kind of inner love for myself, and I don't mind being vulnerable now and speaking about it, because I spent so long doing nothing about it and hiding away in the shadows, as I call it. And like now it's like, if I can help anyone else by sharing my story, I'm happy to do so.
Did you have a mirror in your bedroom?
No, I didn't actually, no.
No, I was just wondering, did you ban mirrors? I mean, or did you stop looking at mirrors? Did you come across the window of a department store and look around? I'm not looking in there.
It'd be the opposite. You'd go past every single window and look in the reflection, because you wanted validation to yourself that you didn't like yourself. I would look in the reflection and go, there you go, see, horrible. And it just, and you just felt you weren't worthy of friends, relationships, love, anything really. And it just, it was actually quite the opposite. I mean, I don't have a weighing scales in my house, and I haven't had one for a long time. I banned them, but that was for my own benefit, really, because obviously with the obsession with the food. Because I would do a lot of binge eating, because you would try and just emotionally just to kind of make yourself feel a little bit better, but then the guilt would start after that. Excuse me. You know, the guilt would start, and then then the next day would be exactly the same. You know, it would control you every day. Like I would wear certain t-shirts. I didn't like my lower back. It was just one part of me I didn't like. I'd go from my head to my toes, and I would list things on my fingers I didn't like about myself. And you would do that constantly. You do that daily, you know, and you know, if you start telling yourself these things all the time, you eventually just believe them.
And how did it affect, you've told us about, you know, how it impacted you, those little things maybe that were mega for you, looking at yourself, but how did it affect, say, relationships, doing work, school, day-to-day life?
It affected everything, really. You would wake up in the morning, you would nearly plan your whole day around trying to conceal your flaws. Like even for example, if I was in a car and I pulled up in traffic, I would turn away because I didn't want people looking at me from the side. I would wear certain t-shirts. I didn't want to go bowling with my friends because I'd have to kind of throw the ball. I didn't want to lean forward because I thought there'd be people behind you. You would go everywhere. You'd be in work, you didn't want to lean forward to pick something up off the ground because you would think people were looking at your lower back. You would, there's a picture I have actually on my Instagram, and it's of me of about 8 or 9 years old, and it's my mother's favourite picture of me, and I'm just wearing a pair of shorts, I've no t-shirt on, and she's, that's her favourite picture of me. And from then until pretty much now, I've never had another picture taken of me without a top on. I've always had clothes on, just because it was just that, you know, it was that big a deal for me. So it would affect your whole day, really, and you would plan your meals, you would start getting obsessed with like taking supplements. And of course, look, if you're not healthy in your mind, you're never really going to be healthy in your body, because they are so intertwined. It's just, I didn't see that at the time, but they are.
And keep turning the corner to get where you are now.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
It kind of happened accidentally, because, I mean, I say accidentally, I was obviously ready to talk about it and I was obviously ready to open up, but the term, I know a lot of people don't like labels, but for me, when someone mentioned the term body dysmorphia, it was like a light bulb went off over my head, because once I looked it up and I learned about it, I was able to tie everything to it. So education was a big thing for me. And once I learned that, I was able to kind of talk to my therapist about it. I was talking to a nutritionist about it. Friends and family, I opened up. There's a great support on Instagram with a lovely community that's there, and I've made so many friends, and they're always there to talk to me if I need, you know, if I need any help and advice. So opening up was a big deal for me, and obviously I started a blog, and writing about it was where the kind of, I wasn't writing about it at the beginning, but a few people had obviously picked up on what I was talking about, and the term body dysmorphia got mentioned to me, and that's how, pretty much how I turned the corner. It was like validation for me, because I was like, okay, well, if there's a term for this, you know, for how I've been feeling, then I must be helping. I must be, you feel very alone, and I felt very lonely for a long time. And I stopped feeling alone when I realised that other people feel like this.
And for somebody who says, God, that's me, what should they do? Where should they go?
Where should they go? Out of their own head would be a start, because I lived in my own head for too long, and that doesn't do you any favours. Talk to someone. Just talk to someone. Once I opened up, the whole world opened up to me. But if it's you and you're feeling like that, please just talk to someone. If it's like a child and you're noticing certain symptoms, go to your GP and get a referral. You need to speak to a professional as well. You know, you just loans and family, but you also need, like, I needed a professional as well to talk to me and explain things to me.
Keith, you're very good to share your story. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
And for coming along to this beautiful hotel in County Wicklow as well to tell it. We're at Druids Glen Hotel, an Ulf resort, and that's Keith Russell, who lived with body dysmorphia. We're at Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort in Wicklow for a special programme today on mental health. Back with more in just a second.
The Morning Show.
The Morning Show.
With Declan Meehan.
On East Coast FM.
Special programme today, concentrating on mental health. We're at Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort near Newtown Mount Kennedy here in Wicklow. We're joined at the programme now by Breed Murphy, who sadly lost her son, Gerard, to suicide. Breed is a big mental health advocate and has helped a lot of people since the death of her son. And some of the helplines she refers to include Samaritans, Aware, It's Good to Talk, Talk to Tom, HSE, Community Health, Wexford. And she's not slow about advocating these to people who talk with her. You're very welcome, Breed. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for
coming
having
in. Me. And so sorry to hear about your son, Gerard. How long ago was this?
It was 13 years on the 3rd of January.
And like yesterday?
Like yesterday. And I don't think it's going to get any better for us as a family. You move on, you create a life around what you have, but it's never any different. We've lost out on Gerard's future. We've lost out on getting married, seeing his career progress. We've lost all that.
Tell us about him.
He was a bright, intelligent, 6'4", gorgeous-looking chap. He had the world at his feet. He was full of life. He was always going someplace, had to get someplace, and even if he ran out of petrol, the car stayed where it was and he got where he was going. He was really a funny, outgoing lad, so it was a complete shock to us all when he died.
Out of the blue?
Absolutely out of the blue. Nobody saw this coming. None of his friends, his brothers and sisters, none of us saw this coming. It was like somebody hit you in the stomach full force with a hockey stick or a hurl or whatever. And the shock of it, I think we're probably still in shock from it, because we've seen no reason for this. He was living at home with my husband, Paddy, and myself. He had everything. He was working with his daddy. And he had a good life, you know, so it was out of the blue that something happened. And I suppose that's why we tried to promote helpline numbers and create awareness, particularly with young people. And we're always looking for them to use the helpline numbers, ring somebody, talk to a friend, talk to a parent. For parents, if they see something wrong, to seek help from these helpline numbers, that they might get a little bit of information on where to go or what to do or how to approach the subject with their child.
And I'm sure, you know, you've asked yourself a million times why. And if only I could, or he'd talk to me, or various things like that. It's what happens, isn't it?
Yes, that's it. And that night that he went out, I was actually had come home from work that evening early. I had to go to the care doc. I was very sick. And he had sat that night with my husband for about an hour chatting in the sitting room. I went out New Year's night, New Year's weekend, like the 2nd of January, he went out with his friends, didn't have much to drink. There was nothing obvious that would have caused this. I actually heard him coming back in, and every day I say, I should have got up when I heard him coming in, and I didn't. But then do you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to check on your children, adult children? You don't, really, you know.
Because a lot of things are commonplace in life, you know what I mean? Yeah, so why would this be different?
Yeah, there was no reason that we could see, and there's still no reason that we can see. But at the same time, maybe if he'd known about helpline numbers, he would have used one. And that's our focus, to promote this, promote the idea of people seeking help and always turn to somebody. There is always somebody there. Just say, I'm not feeling good today. That might be the conversation you need. You might need anything else other than that conversation.
Yes. You know, devastating effect on your family. If, you know, do you sort of feel, had he known? I mean, this might be, you know, silly conversation, but I'm sure a lot of things go through your mind.
Yes, it does, definitely. And whatever this was with Jared was a split second, because there's no way he would have put us all through the heartache that we went through. He's, my mother and my father-in-law were alive that time, and they were, Mammy was 87, Sean was probably 85 at the time, and they had, the impact on them was huge as well as us, you know. It was the whole family, it's a whole ripple effect. It's the family, it's the friends. And then you're kind of dealing with the aftermath of it, with people avoiding you, with people not contacting you. And you're very lucky if you have a close cohort of people that stay with you and stick with you.
Yeah, so the helplines and things, do you find them, you know, responsive? Do you find them active within people's families? People have said to me, and this is maybe totally unfair, said, oh, it's easy to just give out a few numbers and things, you know, and people carry on with their lives. Yet there's a big challenge at home, big challenge with somebody, big, you know, challenge to somebody who's going through something that they need something extra for.
Yes, I mean, there are a lot of people that are going through whatever struggle in their life, and we all go through struggles. I go through struggles all the time. You do. And we learn how to cope and get on with things. And I think that using the helpline number gives somebody the opportunity to speak to somebody. They may not be a counsellor, but they will listen and they will send you where you need to go. And that's the important thing. If you use the helpline, you will get help.
Do you find the campaigning you do and the information you impart is in some way a consolation?
I can't say it's a consolation. We get a lot of calls from people. Our show, we have people from all over Ireland and the UK come to our car show now. It's become the biggest car show in Ireland. We never dreamt of that. It was to be initially 1 year, just to remember Jared on his birthday. That was what it was. And now we find ourselves 13 years later, we're still doing the car show. We raise money, and whatever is raised, it's given out to charities. We self-fund it, so everything has to be paid for to create the event, and whatever is left is given out to the charities. So we put a lot of work into this ourselves, which probably keeps us with the focus of where we're going. And we know that people use the helplines. We get a lot of contact from people all over the country. And I have one counsellor that I've been dealing with for years, and I'm able to make a call to him and say, somebody in Donegal or somebody in Galway or somebody in Kerry looking for help, is there any way you could point them in the right direction? And I'll pass on the phone number, And he has contacts all over Ireland. He'll get somebody to contact that person. And that might be an emergency situation that they need help. And then like that, we give out the helpline number. In every driver that comes to the show goes away with the package with those helpline numbers in them.
Yes. Just to finish, Breedon, thank you for coming from Wexford to join us. What about people that you talk to for you?
Yeah, well, as I said, there's one man that's a counsellor, and I know if I'm under pressure, I generally ring him. He probably sees my number now and says, "Here we are." But he's been a rock to our family, I suppose.
Yes.
But I do. I'm lucky. I have a couple of very good friends, and it does make a difference.
Breed, you're very kind to come up to us. Thank you very much indeed for taking part.
Thank you.
That's Breed Murphy there on East Coast FM. We are live here from Druids Glen in Wicklow, and we have a special mental health programme. Now, we're joined on the show now by Damien Byrne, who's a volunteer at the East Coast Samaritans in Arklow. And East Coast Samaritans, based in Arklow, is fully volunteer with no paid staff, and they are open day and night and link in with other branches. Damien, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, and thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'm here with Barbara, and, you know, you were going to ask about Samaritans. So our mission is to provide emotional support to anyone in distress or at risk of suicide, to promote mental health and well-being.
So generally it's very wide what you do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about the need identified in order to do the work you do.
So the need identified would be that we're there to offer emotional support to anyone that is in distress, and that we're 24-hour helpline, part of a network of different branches. There's 21 branches in the island of Ireland. We answer calls and emails. The email address is joe@samaritans.ie and free phone number 116123. And we're part of a network of service that's there 100% of the time, 24 hours, day and night. It's so crucial, like that.
That somebody is there.
Someone is there to
talk about it. Barbara, absolutely. You're very welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us about your involvement.
Well, I'm a listening volunteer, and I would do telephone duty. I'd be on the other end of the phone when people ring up. You know, our mission is that fewer people die by suicide. On the other hand, not all our calls are about suicide. In fact, quite a small number. Basically, we're there for people who have, who find life difficult, and I would say that one of the most important things we do is to listen. You know, we live in a society that, we live in a busy world, everybody is busy, and, a listening ear is very important. People need to talk, if they're going through difficult situations, emotional upset, and they need somebody to talk to. And in a lot of cases, it might be easier for somebody to ring Samaritans than to talk to a family member.
Do people have a perspective of their problem being big or small? Or
well, sometimes, people... some people ring and they say, "Oh, my problem is only small." But in fact, to them, it's big. You know, if it's affecting their life and they're becoming emotionally distressed, then it's a big problem. So our aim is to listen, to encourage them, support them, show them some empathy, give them time, be kind, so that it gives them a chance to explore their feelings.
And they perhaps work out the solution.
They work out the solution themselves, yeah. We do not advise. We help people to find their own solutions. And this has given people the power to cope with their own lives. We don't take that away from them. We just help them with it.
Yeah, and Damien saying 24 hours a day.
Yes, yeah. Yep. So we do night shifts as well. We're there, and I think that part of it is very important. there's somebody there at night time.
Yeah.
If somebody is suffering from distress and they can't sleep, like 3 o'clock in the
are
morning.
Are there night demons or such?
Is a rough time,
yes.
You know. And there is a saying that I'm very fond of, and it says that, you know, we all like to be the sun that shines on people's day, but let us also be the moon that shines for people in their darkest hour. And I think there's a lot in that small sentence.
Yeah, Damien, you do fantastic work with the Samaritans, and I'm sure you reflect a lot what Barbara says about being there for people.
Absolutely. It's so important. Like this year, we're answering calls 10 years. September is our anniversary. And I'd like to just thank all the volunteers and supporters for making this happen for 10 years. Their dedication, compassion, and generosity just is so, and it's just amazing. Like, and it's huge. It's amazing the amount of support within the branch for each other, and the friendships that you see build and the bonds that you see formed are just absolutely amazing.
Well, you do
and
fantastic
to do
work.
That, to be able to help our callers is so important. Thank you.
Both of you, East Coast Samaritans in Arklow. Thanks to Damien. Thanks to Barbara. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you
and
for
telling
us
what you do.
Thank you.
We're having a special mental health focused programme this morning here at East Coast FM, live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort.
East Coast. The Morning Show with Declan Meehan on East Coast FM.
Yes, good morning and welcome back to The Morning Show on Thursday, January 25th. We are live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort in Wicklow for a very special show today that is completely dedicated to mental health. And over the next hour, we'll continue to look at mental health across all ages, the issues and challenges faced in our community. We will also discover the range of supports available for people who are struggling with their mental health. And we will be speaking to wellness experts about little things we can do to look after our mental health. We'll also speak to mental health volunteers working to provide for those who need it, and we will hear firsthand personal and emotive mental stories. We would again like to issue a small trigger warning. Some of the stories that we'll hear today pertain to suicide and self-harm. It won't be an easy listen for many of you who are listening right now, but hopefully we can start a meaningful conversation this morning about mental health that will continue long after the show ends today. Now, before the end of the programme, we'll also have a very moving performance by the Sea of Change Choir. It's a tribute for all those who have died by suicide and for everyone who has been on or is currently going through their own mental health journey, and for their family members and friends. It'll be a moment to sit, remember and reflect. Now, we're joined here by Katie Murphy. Katie contacted us when she heard we were doing this programme, and Katie's big brother, Dylan, took his own life almost 10 years ago. He was just 22 years old. Katie was 19. Now, since her brother's death, Katie's passion has been all about raising awareness about mental health, especially men's mental health and the mental health of men living in rural towns. Dylan always wanted to work in the film industry, as did Katie, so she followed that path and began working on film production on many movies and shows. And Katie is with us, as I say. You're very welcome, Katie.
Hi.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And what a journey.
Yeah. it's kind of mad when I look back on it that it's been, you know, it's coming up to 10 years now this May since Dylan passed. And I think life has completely changed, and yet it still feels like yesterday when it happened.
Yeah, and Dylan was 22, you were 19, but when you reached 22, you found things particularly difficult.
Yeah, so I suppose I wasn't really expecting it. I mean, obviously, I expected it to be very difficult, and my whole family was devastated when that happened. But when I turned 22 and when I was approaching that birthday, it was very bittersweet because you're suddenly older than your older brother. And all those kind of my 20s were kind of twinged with that bittersweet kind of thing of every milestone you hit, like, you know, finishing college, moving out of the home, all those things. It was, you know, always there that, well, he doesn't get to do these things. And I think especially as him being an older brother, it was just a very strange experience.
Yes, and you kept a journal.
Yeah.
Centered around this age 22.
Yeah, so when I suppose I kind of just woke up one day and obviously, I do, for context, you have a background in theatre. I studied theatre and I studied scripts. So that was kind of my, I suppose, familiar medium. But I just started writing one day and I wasn't a writer, and I called it Surviving 22. And it was pretty much when I turned 22, I started documenting kind of all the highs and lows of navigating your 20s and dealing with grief on top of that. And then very quickly, I suppose, because I wasn't a writer, I didn't know how to write a book, I started kind of writing a script. Initially it was a movie, because that was kind of the format I knew. I never had any intentions of anyone ever reading it. And I think if you were to tell me when I was 22 and started writing that, that someone would read it and it would, you know, be getting made, I would have been, you know, terrified. I suppose it's now, that's 8 years since I wrote that, and now I am a professional screenwriter and I'm writing, that journal has kind of become a TV show and it's called Surviving 22. So last year we received Screen Ireland funding. It's kind of, you know, we have an amazing producer and director on board, and I'm writing the first episode at the moment. So it's amazing to look back and...
But you're writing from the heart. You're... Yeah. Writing from the a real life emotion that you lived through.
I think for me it was probably an outlet, you know, of a way of me, initially of me dealing with grief, and I guess still is. It was, I kind of found writing very therapeutic, and it would help kind of organize my thoughts and how I was feeling about grief and my brother. And then I think it's kind of become so much more. I mean, obviously initially was writing it very much for my brother, and then as more people kind of came on board and got involved and I heard their personal stories and reasons for doing the project, it kind of grew legs, and now it's become many things. I think for me, when I was going through that, it was a really isolating experience. I kind of felt like I didn't connect to anyone around me or my peers, and I didn't really see anyone like me or my family represented on screen. So that was a driving force, was for me writing it was, I suppose, you know, unfortunately there are other families and people out there like me who have lost, you know, be it a brother, a parent, a cousin, a peer, a colleague. So I kind of wanted to write it that maybe someone watching wouldn't feel lonely like I did at the time. And then also ultimately, I mean, I can't change what happened to my brother. I wish I could, but I can't. So I suppose my whole thing is that maybe I can help change the narrative, you know, and the stigma associated with mental health and suicide in Ireland. And maybe someone watching the show will take something from that and go get the help they really need. And
obviously, you were very close to Dylan.
Yeah.
I mean, age-wise, it's only just a couple of years, but having the same interest in film as well and whatever. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was very funny, like a very funny kind of charismatic person. Unfortunately, like, Dylan was an alcoholic from a really young age. It was quite unusual, you know, that issue. But in terms of how young he started drinking, but I think that kind of tainted a lot of his personality. But actually, you know, beyond that, when he was kind of the worst person when he was drunk and the best person when he was sober. And like the Dylan that we know and love, he was super funny. He read a lot of books. He loved movies. He loved music. He actually did want to be at one stage, like as a kid, he used to call himself DJ Dill. And I'm pretty sure he did have some pirate radio thing going on Yeah, I thought you'd like that. So, yeah, he was very, like, big into movies and acting, and he used to always say, like, oh, I'll make it in one day in Hollywood, because he was actually, he was in Ballykiss Angel as a kid.
Right.
So that was kind of his claim to fame. So, yeah, I think, like, in later years when his addiction took over, obviously he wasn't functioning and he couldn't follow that passion. But for me, you know, I suppose it is part of his legacy. I mean, I have that creative storytelling thing going on. I want to tell stories, but yeah, I suppose it's nice kind of doing it as well that I know he wanted to.
So when will we see Surviving 22 then?
that is the golden question. We are currently in development, and the next stage is kind of to try and get it up and greenlit on your screen, but watch this space. Hopefully,
well, it's great to get the backing of Screen Ireland as well. Yeah. So keep in touch with us. You're doing fantastic work, and I'm sure the finished product will be of great benefit to many people.
Thank you. I hope so.
It's great to meet you, Katie. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for coming in. That's Katie Murphy on The Morning Show at East Coast. We're live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort near Newtown Mount Kennedy. Joining us now, Helen Walsh, Health and Life Coach. You're very welcome, Helen.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. You've often spoken to us in the past about mental health and doing maybe one small thing every day to your mental health can help strengthen your resilience and help you feel a whole lot better. I know you've gone sea swimming and all sorts of things, but tell us more how we should maybe look after ourselves.
So there's lots of little routine things that really help. And when you're depressed or you're feeling a bit miserable or whatever, like sometimes you don't even want to get out of the bed, never mind make it. But looking after your initial space or your immediate space is a really good way to help start your day. So if you can push yourself even a little bit just to, you know, clean the space that you're using, have your cup of tea, wash up after it. Now, as I said, that can be a stretch for people who are depressed and that may not be something that they're able to do, and if they're at that stage they really should be going for some help. If you're suffering with mental health, you should be advised anyway, you should be going for medical advice. But I'd really love to add a caveat to that and say this: if you look up a lot of the advice around mental health, one of the first things they'll say to you is go and talk to somebody, to have a conversation with someone, have a chat with someone, tell someone. But it has to be the right person. Because you might say it to somebody, say, in the family, and they're like, ah, yeah, sure, you know, you'll get out of this. This is just a bit of a low for you, and you'll be okay. Or you might go to a GP, and they're doing amazing jobs around this, but you might go to a GP that knows you since you were a kid. And so they go, ah, sure, you're a strong character, you'll be fine, or whatever. So I think it's really, really important that if you're struggling with your mental health and that you really feel that it's out of control for you, that whoever you have the conversation with says to you, I hear you, I get it, now let's put a plan in place, or what's our next step? People keep away from medication sometimes and they think, oh, I never want to take an antidepressant, or I never want to. But it actually can be an absolute game changer for a short period of
prescribed time.
Yeah, just to get, you'll feel like someone plugged you back in again.
So you need the professional involved.
Yeah, I if you're really struggling, yes, don't bypass that and think that you're going to handle it all yourself, because sometimes you just need that little step. I always say to people, if you had a broken arm, you would not go, you know, for 6 months and say, ah, sure, it'll probably mend itself. Yes, it probably would, but it's not going to mend correctly. So it's the same thing. You just need to get the right advice. And there's loads of lovely people out there. The helplines are amazing. I've had conversations with people in the clinic all the time where they say, oh, I just feel a bit guilty ringing the helplines and I feel like I'm taking up time. Take up their time. If you are in trouble, that's what they're there for. They are amazing. They have the experience. When you say something, they will know exactly what you mean by what you're saying.
Mm. But those little things, and I know you're into health and fitness and all that. I mean, you hear things, oh, sure, if you were out for a walk or something, getting fresh air, sure, that'll solve everything.
It doesn't solve everything, but it changes your state. So when you are in a state of anxiety in particular, you're in what's called a state. So there's a couple of quick ways you can change your state. You can take yourself out for a walk, and anything to do with nature tends to really give you those endorphins and that lift. So go for a walk by the sea, go for a walk around trees, you know, take a neighbor's dog for a walk, whatever it takes, just you're changing your state. Now, you're not going to like this one, but the cold shower is brilliant for changing your state. Mm. So some days, if you're feeling just a little bit off and the head is going and you really don't know how to stop it, go in, have a nice shower, and then at the end, blast the cold water. It physically will hit the nervous system and change your state. That's why so many people, I think, are addicted even to the sea swimming, because it goes right in. It's one of the few things that goes into the nervous system and will rehash the whole nervous system. And when you are suffering with anxiety, it's the the nervous system really that takes the hit. We're great at talking about all the head stuff and all the physical stuff and the workout, and we neglect that whole thing of the nervous system. So, and compassion for yourself. I know it sounds very cliche, but be kind to yourself. Like, don't say, oh my God, I'm stupid this and I'm ridiculous and I can't get myself together and I can't. No, you can't right now. So what? You know, so what? Like, the main thing is, right now, what's the best possible thing for you? And I also find the list to be a great thing to do if you're feeling overwhelmed. There's a lot of stuff on the news and everything at the moment that's very overwhelming for people. So write your list. What are you actually worried about right now? Now, take your pen and say, right, out of that list, what am I in control of? What do I have personal control over? And then scrape off the rest of them.
Okay.
Or whatever. And then all of a sudden that list is going to go from 10 things to 2 things.
Because you feel you're getting somewhere. Great to see you again, Helen.
Yeah, I'm delighted to come in and speak to you today. I'm very passionate about this, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Helen Walsh, the health and life coach. And we are live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort near Newtown Mount Kennedy here in Wicklow. Special on mental health this morning. Plenty more to come here. And hopefully you'll stay with us till noon today. Morning Show at East Coast.
The Morning Show.
The Morning Show.
With Declan Meehan.
On East Coast FM.
And we're live this morning from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort. We have a special mental health programme till 12 today. And I hope you're getting some benefit from that. Still plenty more to come. We're joined in studio now here at Druids Glen by Matt Keenan. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, Declan, how are you?
Good morning to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a million for having me. Really appreciate it.
And Matt set up the Anxious Lad Mental Health Company after struggling with his own mental health. And Matt went through a mental breakdown in 2021. And was misdiagnosed by his doctor with depression. He was given medication, which was increased each month until he was on a very high dosage every single day by August. And by this time, Matt had completely checked out, felt nothing, left the house in his car one day in August with the intention of taking his own life. Well, Matt is still here, thankfully. you're very welcome, Matt. Tell us about your thoughts back then. What goes through your mind back then when you're rationalizing what you're going to do to get out of this?
That's the thing. It was the logic behind it is scary, you know. For me, it was, I'd completely checked out. Like I said, the medication for me, it didn't lend itself well to me. And it got to the point where I was constantly arguing and fighting with everybody around me, you know, destroying relationships, drinking a hell of a lot as well, to the point where I thought, I'm done. Everybody will be better without me, kind of thing.
Mm. Even though you were interacting with people, would that not give you a purpose?
You say interacting, but I was present. I guess it's probably the easiest way of putting it. I was physically present, but not emotionally present. Do you know what I mean? With my wife, my kids, everyone around me. And then it got to the point, as I said, I had just completely checked out of it. I thought, no, I'm done. The company I was working for at the time, there was a really good death and service package. So if I died whilst working for the company, there was a good insurance payout. But that doesn't work if it's suicide, obviously. So for me, the logic was, well, how do I make it look like it's not suicide? And the answer to that is the coroner, state pathologist, can't rule even a single car accident as suicide. It has to be ruled as a road traffic accident. So my means to take my life was to drive the car as fast as I can.
And were you dispassionate, the planning all this?
Yeah, not really. No, for me, it was, okay, the decision's made, now I'm happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, it felt like there was a weight lifted off my shoulders when I decided that's what was going to happen. That was the weird part. And then knowing that financially my wife and kids would be okay, then there was a sense of relief, I guess, in that. Do you know what I mean? That financially they'd be taken care of, the mortgage is paid, the bills would be paid. I wouldn't be there, but for me that was, I don't need to keep living like this. I don't need to keep feeling the way I'm feeling. Do you know what I mean? So,
and was there a calmness then with you? A calmness when you've decided and you know what your plan of action is? Because I heard Stephen Fry talking about it, that people arrive at a situation where they plan to take their own lives and they seem happy in the final sort of stage before the execution, if you pardon the word, about it, because they've decided. And then people say, but they seem so happy. you know, people afterwards.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, there is, as you quite rightly said, there is a sense of calmness about it. The decision is being made. The plan is put in place. You then know that, okay, it's only going to be a certain amount of time, whether it's a couple of days or a couple of weeks or whatever it is, that I need to keep feeling like this. And at the end of it, then it's done. I'm finished. So there is that element of being a lot more calmer, getting stuff done. And talk about it in suicide intervention training and stuff, where you talk about putting out invitations. Do you know what I mean? They're going to see people that you haven't seen before or seen in a while. Tidying, cleaning, putting your affairs in order, that kind of stuff. The happiness, all of a sudden you go from being okay to being, geez, the last couple of days he was really happy over the last few days. That's an invitation. We're creatures of habit, right? So when somebody decides that they want to end their lives or take their own lives, you might see a slight change in behaviour all of a sudden. And that's when you kind of need to step in and kind of say, hang on, is everything all right?
Keep for the loved ones left behind, that's frightening.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely is. But look, this isn't an easy conversation to have, you know. And as I said, when you go through the other side of it, like, I've done a lot of training since in setting up the company and the different awareness programs and stuff that I'm doing. And when we look at suicide ideation, and as I said, like, the invitations that people put out there, if you don't know, Declan, you don't know. That's the reality of it. You know, I didn't know I was putting out these invitations. It was only when I went through the training afterwards, I realised, actually, I was probably doing that, or I was doing this. And I know people who have taken their lives before, and when I look back on certain behaviours in the days and weeks leading up to it, now I can spot where those invitations were. So, yeah.
Yeah, so take us back to 2021 and the difficulties you had then.
So, I mean, look, on the face of it, everything was going fine, you know. I had a really good job. I was working for a tech company. We were renting a house at the time, you know, three kids, a beautiful wife, everything was going swimmingly, you know. On the face of it, everything was perfect. I've always had anxiety. I just never really knew what it was. So it manifested in different ways. It might have been that I have nightmares, I don't sleep well, I have patterns of, you know, sleep distortion and that kind of stuff, that would make me then be angry or moody or whatever way you want to put it. But then I think lockdowns, and as you know yourself, we had severe lockdowns over here, that kind of exacerbated the whole thing. So it got to January, February of 21, and boom, I hit absolute rock bottom. Went to the doctor. I had done different therapy before, and I thought, okay, look, I'll go to the doctor, see what he says. So he said I was displaying the characteristics of depression. So he said, well, you've got clinical depression, here's a load of medication, go and take them and you'll be fine. So I started taking the meds, and he said, look, check in with me in a month, let's see how you're going. A month later, I thought, I don't really feel any different. And he's like, okay, well, let's just check the balance, or check the medication itself, to increase it if we have to, get your dosage right. And that kept happening every month up until the August time. So I went from 37.5 milligrams in February to 265 milligrams in August. And as I said, by that time, I was just a shell of myself. Now, I'm not against medication in any way, shape or form. They suit people. It's like I always say, it's horses for courses, Declan, you know. They suit some people, they don't suit other people. For me, they just didn't lend themselves well to me at all. And I guess I wasn't dealing with... I have really bad anxiety. That's what my therapist had discovered with me after the suicide thoughts. So I was spending those months on medication trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I live with depression? And my anxiety is getting bigger and bigger because I think I have depression, where in actual fact it was anxiety. I was dealing with the wrong symptoms and dealing with the wrong illness. So after the suicide thing, I went and saw a really, really good therapist. And after maybe 10 hours with her, we realised actually it's severe anxiety, or GAD, I live, so generalised anxiety disorder, that I live with. And once we figured that out, it was like a light bulb went off.
Right. And then you went on to create The Anxious Lad, a mental health company. So
that's it.
What is that?
So The Anxious Lad is the brand. So we've got three parts to it. So there's an awareness element, which is The Anxious Lad podcast. I was fortunate enough to get that into the top 10 on Spotify in 2022. Last year, we're in 26 countries around the world being streamed in. And I've got the anxious lad life coaching. So I do mental health life coaching for men who live with anxiety, depression, that kind of stuff. And then there's the education side of it, where I'm a certified mental health first aid and suicide first aid instructor. So I do workshops, training days, certifying companies and people with mental health first aid and suicide awareness.
And where can people find you?
So theanxiouslad.ie is probably the best place to start. Or if you just search The Anxious Lad or Matt Keenan on Facebook or anything like that, you'll find me there.
Right. And yeah. You're glad you turned around the car and came home?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Matt, great to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thanks for being there.
Hopefully we talk again. Thank Cheers. You. That's Matt Keenan there, Bray resident who set up the Anxious Lad Mental Health Company. It's the morning show at East Coast FM. We are live from Drew's Glen Hotel and Golf Resort today. We're talking about mental health. And joining us now is Michael Stafford. Michael's been a volunteer at Aware since 2015 and had also his own struggles with his mental health in the past. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Declan. How are you?
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about your journey.
Well, my journey in mental health started when I volunteered for Aware back in 2015, and I found them to be a great organisation to be able to support people with mental health. So I volunteered with them and got on their support line and started to help other people on the line. I suppose the push was because I was a coach, I wanted to increase my listening skills, and I found that was a way of getting some great training in that regard. But also I had some family members who were living with mental health issues over the years as well, so I felt I could support them in the best possible way.
Mm. The pandemic, of course, intervened with life, and for yourself, long COVID.
Yeah, so the 14th of September 2020, I lost my taste or smell. And it hasn't returned since.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so that's been the big thing for me. Now, I had a number of other issues that happened throughout my long COVID battle and struggles, but they are the two things that still remain that haven't come back.
And the prognosis is eventually?
The prognosis is... Well, I want to give a message of hope, but the prognosis is it may come back or may not.
Right, well, fingers crossed. But I could imagine that would interfere with your mental health.
Totally. And throughout the pandemic, it became very obvious to me, having had all of the skills and training, that I still was needing extra support myself. So I went to my GP. I was diagnosed with a correct prescription, I would call it at the time. And it helped to lift my mood in the best possible way. But the supports that were there and available, Declan, you'd be surprised how many times people mention anything to do with taste or smell on a daily basis. So you have to try to change your mindset around the fact that, well, I was avoiding going for meals or dinners with people because what was the point? But then
it's
I wasn't seeing my friend.
Stuff in your mouth.
Yeah, yeah. And then I worked with I'm a trained coach myself, but I worked with a coach and a coach supervisor and a counsellor to try and change my mindset around, well, where's the joy in going for a meal? And the joy is really going for with friends and family and sitting with them. So yes, the meal might not be able to taste it, but you can sit and enjoy the company of people again. And that has helped massively. But I do have a wish that it will come back.
Yeah. And, I mean, day to day, when not talking about food or drink or taste, but how this has impacted upon you, how has it affected your behaviour?
Yeah, well, I describe it as, if anyone's ever seen The Wizard of Oz, you'll see the very part at the beginning, and it's all in grey, and then she lands in Oz, and the Technicolor comes in.
Yes.
Yeah. I always say that my life is a bit in the grey at the moment because of the taste and smell being gone, because your immune system with COVID, and you know, living with long COVID, your immune system still thinks that COVID is present. So it's sacrificing anything that your immune system doesn't need to survive. So you have to try to reset everything. So I work with a lot of holistic practitioners at the moment, trying to bring the taste or smell back. But I have to be positive about it, because otherwise,
You have to, accept this, because you can't change it. But I mean, that's just glib, is it?
Yeah, I mean, the long COVID trial that I did in the matter at the end of a year and a half was like, okay, we've done everything. And they repaired an awful lot of other stuff that had gone on for me, like gut health and so on. I got vertigo. I lost my sight for a few days. I was really struggling. And to tie in depression and mental health on top of that as well, it was like, oh God, what else is going to happen in that regard? But yeah, it's coming back to it and saying, okay, you don't have this, but what can you control? And I can totally control reaching out to people and getting support and looking for alternatives to try and find a solution to getting my taste or smell back.
Mm. Now, you're a volunteer for Aware. What's Aware?
Aware is a mental health charity that is based in Dublin, but they have offices around the country. Aware focuses very much on people living with mood-related disorders like depression, anxiety and bipolar.
Right. Now, you're talking to people who have difficulties. You're hearing the woes of the world and people's difficulties. And there you are. So does it have an influence?
Yes, and during COVID, I took a sabbatical from Aware for 6 months to manage my own mental health because I was being triggered on the calls where I was supporting people. People were ringing in and they were complaining. And when I say complaining, they were concerned about their long COVID journey, for example. And it does trigger for you straight away. You know, if someone says, I can't get up out of the bed because my lungs have been affected, and you're saying, oh God, I think I'd rather that than actually have no taste or smell. And you're matching that up to other people's illnesses. So, you know, Aware were very supportive, and I took some time out. But I'm back now and I'm supporting people because out of all of the issues that did happen to me, it's just my taste or smell now. And I'm living with it.
Right. There's a lot going on in the world, and cost of living and wars and all sorts of issues that people have. I mean, you know, you're trying to help somebody. You've got this going on in your head. You know, you've got maybe, you know, other aspects of long COVID. I mean, how do you cope?
Looking at tips for coping and looking at things that make you feel well, and look, you know, support from family and friends. And you know, I'm setting up a podcast that's going live in April called Can We Talk Sense, which is going to be giving a platform to people to really focus in on their long COVID wellness journey and recovery journey. It's important not to focus on the suffering element, but give people hope and positivity that things will change. Just like what Matt said earlier on, you know, I'm glad he turned that car around and the life that he's now living and the journey that he's on. It's important that we can make changes and support other people on the way.
I was looking about you, Michael. It's Michael Stafford, is a Aware volunteer. You were president of the Ireland chapter of the International Coaching Federation.
Absolutely.
That sounds rather grand.
So I'm a trained coach, and I have the privilege of working with the ICF board in Ireland from 2018. And in 2020, I had the role of the president, and that was a challenge for the chapter. Ireland has about, at last count, it was about 470 members that are coaches of the International Coaching Federation. So we wanted to not only support them, but support the community as well. So we set up a campaign called Calm in Your Community, really to try and help people to navigate the pandemic, which was really young at that time.
Right. And to finish, Michael, what would you say to somebody struggling at the moment?
I would say, reach out to people, and when I say people, I mean trained professionals where possible. Family and friends are there to support. Don't ever feel like you're a burden. You may not always get the best advice from people, but know that there is hope out there and there are supports. And as a nation, we are changing our conversation around mental health and getting better at being vulnerable, especially with men. And, you know, sharing your story, I think, will help other people.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing that a lot this morning. It's talk, isn't it?
Talk to people.
Indeed. Yeah. Great to talk to you, Michael. Thank you for sharing your story with us this morning.
Thank you, Declan.
That's Michael Stafford there, who's an Aware volunteer. It's Morning Show at East Coast, live from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort. We're talking mental health. We've got some more.
Morning Show
with Declan Meehan
on East Coast FM.
Yeah, the morning show broadcast this morning from Druids Glen Hotel and Golf Resort. Now on the programme, we're going to hear from a Wicklow woman who lost her son to suicide only 3 weeks ago on New Year's Day. Anna Lawler is going to tell us about her son, Owen. Now, this interview is going to be very difficult, and we just want to issue a trigger warning with it. Good morning, Anna. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, yeah.
Tell us about Owen.
Owen, from the day he was born, was loved and cherished. And a day went by when our extended family, he has two older sisters that adored him, me, my brothers, everybody, literally every day he was loved, told how much we were proud of him. Didn't matter what he did, you know, he had this cheeky little grin about him that he was just, if any mother could be so proud of a son, I couldn't be so much prouder of Owen and everybody. I mean, Susie now, his eldest sister, is 14 years older than him. She was like a second mother. Her husband was like a big brother. He had fantastic friends, beautiful, caring girlfriend, Shannon, who he would have been with 5 years on the 3rd of January. Her family was like a second family to him. It's just all his friends. Everybody, nobody could say a bad word against him. He was just one of those that you instantly liked.
Yeah.
He was like really high. He loved his Muay Thai when training 3-4 nights a week now with Rob. He was just, he was a wonderful son. And if he was staying in his girlfriend's house, he'd always text me. I mean, at 22, text his mother good night every day. Or even if I went out to work before him or he went out to work before me, we'd always just send a text like, have a great day. He was my world. He was my everything. Now, last year, he came to me before Christmas, and he just said that little things were getting on top of him. So we all sat down, and we had a big old chat. And, you know, as I said, you know, he knew he could come to me with anything. And if he couldn't talk to me, he could talk to one of his sisters. You know, I mean, there was always somebody there that was, I mean, he could arrive on his sister's doorsteps at whatever hours of the morning. You know, he could come to me with anything. And like, you know, as I said, everything can be sorted. Even talking about it is half the pressure off. It releases half the problem. A problem shared is a problem left.
Yeah.
And anything could be dealt with. So we did. We had a bit of a wobble last Christmas and everything. Then he got right back into his training. He won his fight there last October, the 7th, down in Cork. His confidence went through the roof. He was in top form. I've never seen him so happy. All through, we moved to a new house. He was having his friends around. He was just so happy. He started a new job. Robbie as a roofer. Everything was going right. Every single thing was going right. And he was just so happy. At Christmas, he played all the games with us. He was just in fantastic form, brilliant form. But then coming up to New Year's, he said his phone wasn't really working that well, that his charger was broken. And don't worry if I didn't get any texts, because his phone was broken. So he said, would it be all right if he had friends over on New Year's Eve? And I always spent New Year's Eve with my mum. So I said, of course, delighted, you know. So he says, yeah. So that morning, he gives me a huge, huge hug. I'd got him a fire stick for Christmas. And gives me a big hug and a big kiss. And he says, I'm just wishing you Happy New Year now, just in case my phone isn't working. And he said, just now, and I'll see you tomorrow. And I said, that's great, love, and everything. And I went off. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I rang him, and he didn't answer. So I thought, like, oh, maybe he's watching film. Didn't think anything of it. By 9 o'clock that night, I had a feeling in my bones there was something just not right. He wasn't answering. He always answered. And my mum said, sure, he's with his friend and his girlfriend. He doesn't want his mammy bringing him. So I said, that's true, you know. Didn't want to be nagging when he's with his friends. So I ignored him. So, well, I just didn't think. So I sent Happy New Year to Mo, but I got one back from Shannon. So I said, that's good. At least Shannon is there. It's from the two of them. And then I went to work the following day, and I got that dreaded phone call. It's 12:32. I'll never forget it. That I had to go home to a medical emergency.
And I got home there and he hung himself during the night in his wardrobe. Yeah. That was it. That's the day my world ended.
Was this the furthest thing from your mind that you'd know? Indication.
He was the happiest, even on the Saturday night. I said, because I came home from work. Now, he had been out with his best friend, Ryan, on the Friday. So he didn't come home to the early hours of the morning. So when I came home from work, he was apologising. I said, you have one hell of a hangover. And we were joking about it. And he made me dinner, chicken burgers and chips. And he was apologising because he had slightly burnt the bun. I didn't care. And I said, are you not going out with Shannon tonight? And he said, like, no, Shannon's going out with her friends. I'm sitting in with you and watching a movie. And we sat in and we watched the latest of Spider-Man. And we were just, he was my, there was nothing. He was just, no signs at all, nothing.
And you've asked yourself, I'm sure, why on probably, you know, loads and loads of times.
In the messages, it just said that just things got too much for him and that I wasn't to be mad at him. But I could never be mad at him, and I'm not mad at him, and I never will be mad at him. If anything, I blame myself. I feel guilted. I feel so much guilt. I feel cheated. And it's just... If he could see, I mean, if he could have seen his funeral, they couldn't even fit into the church. The church was overflowing. Was that many? The priest had even said he'd never seen so many young people ever there. Like, I mean, it was just...
Yeah.
But there was no warning. He was just on the outside, so happy. He was looking forward to... He had another fight coming up February or March. So he was training. He was keeping his weight down so he wouldn't have to do all the saunas and everything. I mean, he was just dedicated to his sport, loved his job. You'd be walking down the road with him and he'd be looking at people's roofs and just... Nothing.
Yeah. Since then, you know, just after Christmas, I mean, you'll never come to terms with this, isn't this?
Never.
People say to you, oh, you know, maybe with a passage of time, but I can hear it in your voice, Anna. Yeah.
If there had been some indication that something was bothering them, something there, at least you could say, you know, well, I should have taken notice, but there wasn't. I mean, himself and Shannon, God love her, they'd said that they'd go small in Christmas presents this year and they were going to save up and go to Thailand about August, and then they'd probably go on to Australia. They said, all plans, everything. They were only after coming back from Amsterdam on a holiday. I mean, looking at it, his photos, He's just so happy in every single one of them. But in hindsight, and even being, it was planned. He planned it to do it on that day. And I don't know why. And it's just, as I say, I just feel so guilty. I'm in my 50s. I can still go to my mum and talk to her about anything. My children can do it. So I just, why couldn't he? I mean... Nothing is that bad that it can't be solved.
And I know that
anybody out there is out there. I mean, like, everything can be fixed. I mean, you don't necessarily have to go to talk to a parent, a coach, friend, even go and talk to a total stranger.
But I know that's the message you want to get across to people today. It's no matter how bleak and bad it appears, to, you know, talk to somebody.
Yeah, because This is a mother's worst nightmare, multiplied by 10. You do hear it. You hear people committing suicide and you say, like, oh, God, love them. But until it actually hits you that you realise it's just... Now, I know this sounds really weird and everything, but in a way, I'm glad he did it at home. So he was there instead of going up a field or a hill where he might not have been found. So for that, I know it sounds sticking away, but for that I'm grateful. Because when I saw him, when they allowed me in to see him, he just looks so peaceful. He just looks, he looked like my baby boy. And that's what he'll always be.
How are other members of the family, Anna?
We're all just numb to me now because I couldn't go. As I say, it was only me and him. We only moved to Shankill 6 months ago. So it was just the two of us. So I naturally couldn't. So I'd be staying down with my mum. But I mean, we're all just to me now. The only way I can deal with going home is... In my head, I just say that he's staying the night in Shannon's. So it's just, I can't come to terms with that. I'm never going to see him again yet. I just can't. And only for the support of my mum and my daughters, my son-in-law, my brothers, his friends. I mean... I wouldn't, work have been amazing. I work for Corners Court and I'm telling you the staff there have absolutely been amazing. But, only for that, I don't think I could have coped. And I just want to do him proud.
Anna, you're very good to speak publicly about this and, you know, to try and help others. And we can feel, you know, the pain that you have. And I mean, I can't say anything to you. I can't say, oh, should you have memories or anything? They just seem so
I have beautiful
trite.
Memories. Yeah, and I keep looking at the photos from Christmas Day. And, you know, we went to my daughter Susie's house and we were all just there playing silly games. And, you know, we all played every single one of them. Normally he'd be on the phone and he didn't. He played every single game. He took part in everything. He just, you know, so I have wonderful, wonderful memories. Even him cooking me dinner that Saturday night, I will never forget that. I mean, so I have wonderful memories. Every single memory I have of him is wonderful, wonderful memories.
Anna, thanks for helping others today.
As I say,
and taking part in a program.
There's always somebody there to listen. Always, I mean, just talk to somebody. It's just, if it helps even one person, it will make it that much easier.
Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, bye-bye.
And you look after yourself now.
Thank you.
And bye-bye. I'm sure the family will try to look after you too. Thank you, Anna.
Yes, they do indeed. Thank you so much. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The Morning Show at East Coast FM. Now, to finish off the programme today, we have a very special performance by the Sea of Change Choir, who are known for spreading hope and inspiration. This performance is a tribute to all those who died by suicide and to anyone listening now who may have had their own struggles with mental health or are currently on their own mental health journey. And, of course, to their family members and friends. Take a moment to sit, reflect, and just enjoy the sound of the fabulous Sea of Change Choir, who kindly contributed to our broadcast today.
Better days are coming, even though I told you. I hate to hear you crying over the phone, dear. For 7 years running, you've been a soldier. But better days are coming, better days are coming for you. So when the night feels like forever, I remember what you said to me. I know you've been hurting. just wait for better days. You've seen too much of pain. Now you don't even know that your story's gonna change. Just wait for better days. I promise you I won't let go. I know you've been hurting, waiting on a train that just won't come. The rain, it ain't permanent, and soon sing our song together.
The Sea of Change Choir. And thank you to everyone who has taken the time to join us here at Druids Glen Hotel this morning to share their stories. And of course, back with more soon.